Okay, so this workshop is about transience, and it's a very popular topic. It was also a popular topic 100 years ago and became not so popular in between. But there's a sense, I think, many of us have, that this subject is about to take off at optical wavelengths first, and hopefully in a few years at radio wavelengths. Okay. And, well, there are two ways to look at. I want to summarize in the next two plots, next two view graphs, the spirit of this workshop, which is, well, one could say it's an age-old refrain from 1806. It says, twinkle, twinkle, little star, which is, you know, wearable, wearable, little star, how I wonder what you are. Up above the world is so high, like a diamond in the sky. And actually it says in 1806, a wearable, wearable, little star, how I wonder what you are. Okay, well, this is sort of the explore phase space, and this is sort of the tack taken by, I would say, many conferences. It's a familiar theme, and my view is that that's not the tack we should be taking here in the next 2 days. It's always good to explore new phase space. It's such a motherhood statement. How could anyone dispute that? However, one could, because we have a Nobel laureate, so we skip another 100 years, 2005, you know, sort of his life biography. Giacconi notes somewhere in his annual reviews that he's talking about how they put together the X-ray instrumentation. Serendipity was always hoped for, but did not set the experimental parameters. And in my mind, this is the important thing, that too many of these projects, LSST in particular, I noticed, you know, there's a lot of, well, variable stars, it's fantastic, we'll do new things. It's all right. You can always say we'll do new things, but it helps to think a little bit about it. It's the prepared mind which understands the discovery. Okay, so I'm not going to come and tell you, well, we'll find these absolutely stunning new things, all sorts of things. The spirit of this particular talk is to look at things we know and then make mild extrapolations, you know, and then speculate a few things based on the physics and astrophysics that's reasonably well known. Okay, explosive transients. Well, the most common explosive transient in our galaxy, happening almost one every one per square degree per day, is a stellar flare. They're very impressive, actually. And in my mind, young theorists, even though it's not obviously the most sexy topic, the physics of this is very impressive. And it's well worth looking into that. And especially galaxies will add a lot of, because that's where the signal is the strongest. However, well, they're impressive, but they're not really explosive, so we throw them out, even though they're the most common guys. And in fact, it is through the haze of these flares and the Kuiper and the solar system objects that we have to seek out our favorite transient. So whether you like it or not, solar system objects, stellar flares, will be something you'll get used to, and you might as well start liking them. So you can write a few papers on the side. Okay, novae and supernovae. This we have come to know over years as two major families, and I'll try to give a summary physics view of what's the difference between these two families. And then over time we have learned, you know, the afterglow, which is basically, it is an explosion, but the actual mechanism is you have this very fast moving shock wave, and you get both a forward and a reverse shock. And a common example, of course, that everyone thinks of GRBs. So even though the phenomena is only for 10 seconds, the afterglows can last for days and years, depending on the wavelength. You can add to that in a similar thing with magnetar flares. They're less dramatic, but they also can be relativistic and certainly do produce long-lived emission well beyond the explosion. Okay, so I will focus on these two. We'll hear some talks on stellar flares. We'll certainly hear a lot about GRBs, off and afterglows, and all that sort of stuff. This is a little dense. I'm sorry. I'm still not very clear how to make in PowerPoint all the. It just seems very laborious to build it up. So I just cut and paste. Yeah. Okay. So the key thing is, let's say, what is the energy? We consider an explosion. The idea is to get a basic idea. Let's try to understand these explosions independent of all the details, because each family is important, and we tend to, but it's this equation, I think, will give you an overall view of explosion. So the main thing is there's an energy in an explosion, which is kinetic energy, photon energy. Okay? And they're two separate things. And you can see, in fact, the energy per unit volume is simply the standard 3/2 NKT plus a radiative term from photons AT to the 4. No dispute on this. Now, what happens to this energy? Well, this energy, in fact, loses. This energy is the one differential equation for governing a spherical explosion is the rate of change of this internal energy is due to some gains and losses. Well, let's do the losses first. You could be radiating some photons at the surface, L of T, and you're certainly expanding, sometimes called as adiabatic expansion, sometimes called PDU work, and these are losses. In some cases, and those are the only explosions we actually end up studying, in some cases, you will be adding energy. And how you add energy defines the class of explosion. Okay, and I'll come to that. So that is the heat input into the system. And immediately I can tell you the two families, novae and supernovae, epsilon of T is done in two different ways. In supernovae, epsilon of T simply comes from radioactive decay of nickel 56. And in the nova family, epsilon of T comes from a hot surface of a compact object, i.e. a white dwarf. And it is this term that, in fact, allows these explosions to go well beyond the what I'd call as a pure explosion duration. Then there are details. The pressure is a gas pressure plus photon pressure. And then the dynamics. How does this expand? Is it an accelerating thing or is it coasting? So let's not go into that. But you can now solve this equation. You can solve this equation analytically if you set epsilon of T to 0. Okay? You said, I have no heat input. I have this explosion. I want to know what it looks like, a pure explosion. Okay, you can solve that under two conditions. You can say there's a photon-dominated explosion, in which case that P is dominated by AT to the 4 over 3. You get an exact solution, which is well known in the supernova literature. It's sometimes called the shock breakout and so on. But it says basically you have constant luminosity up to a time scale, which is the geometric mean of the so-called hydrodynamic time scale, which is the time it takes for the explosion to cross itself, the progenitor star, and the photon diffusion time scale at T equals 0. So this is a characteristic time scale. So a pure explosion will be revealed for a certain length of time given by the geometric mean of this, and L naught, which is simply the initial energy, photon energy, divided by the diffusion time, and that has to do with the size of the star. So the larger the progenitor star, the larger is L naught. Okay? Well, there's another solution, actually, which is not discussed much in literature, and for a good reason. You can go back to this and say, oh, well, instead of using P here, in the first case I said P equals only the second term, I can say P is equal to the gas term. And then you'll find, in fact, it looks the same thing, except now it's even faster. It's now going on a time scale much, much faster, T or TH. And the hydrodynamic time scale, remember, is simply the size of the star divided by the explosion speed. So for small objects, it's a very small number. So this falls very quickly, and you'd not see these such explosions. So you can have an explosion, which is hot stuff, okay? Gas pressure dominated. You'll never see it, because the only way we see explosions is, in fact, through their photon emission. Okay, the one case is not true, of course, is GRB afterglows, where photons are simply not involved. Okay. So if you want to have explosions, it's not enough to have explosions. It's explosions with long-lasting emission. That's a key thing, because what I spoke is the natural time scale. And I'll summarize this in a minute. But if you want to have time scale beyond the square root of T times T, TD times TH, then you need something else. You need to go back and say, I need to start injecting energy so that I can gradually radiate and last a long time. Supernova family, they do that by radioactive decay. Nova family by central heating of a compact source. Afterglow family is a completely different thing. You have non-radiative shocks that slowly convert the shock energy. Okay. So again, during my talk, I'll look at variations of these two themes. Okay, so I've summarized here, and I think it's actually a nice way to look at various phenomena. I've summarized here as, I used MV because the idea is that the progress we are talking of is primarily happening in the optical thanks to huge development in CCD arrays, huge developments in computing. So The idea is, and it could, you can substitute other bands, but MV is the peak magnitude. So we're looking for an explosion, say what is the peak magnitude and the time it takes to achieve this peak. Okay, those are our two numbers. It's usually hard, as we all know, to measure the time to achieve peak. Many, if you look at supernova literature, they always tell you the time to fall away from the peak because they're discovered kind of rising, and so it's hard. But theoretically, it's better to talk of the time to peak. It captures a sense of the explosion in a better way. Okay, so I have here MV, and it goes from minus 8 magnitude to minus 22. It's a huge range, absolute magnitude. And the time to peak, and I've gone only from 10 to the minus 2 days, which is about 1,000 seconds, to 10 to the 2 days here. Now I know, you know, we have some great experiments. We'll hear from Tom Westrand. They're very fast things. But I want to focus here on things I understand. And those experiments will reveal essentially what I would say would be highly relativistic phenomena or very small sources. And the way you can look at this is you can say, well, we are looking in the optical, and therefore we are only looking at plasma, which will radiate, which should be hot, but not too hot. If it is too hot, it'll be in the UV. If it's too cold, it won't radiate in the optical. So I'm just going to plot something where the plasma temperature is 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And then we are saying, what object has expansion speed of C? And then it's very simple, black body radiation. That's the line. So the rough idea is this line over here in the optical band would be all relativistic phenomena. It's these guys, it's the non-relativistic part that I'm focusing on. And then again, we'll hear some talks here, which are mainly to do with GRB afterglows and orphan afterglows, whose mean speed actually, for the ideal orphan afterglow, the mean speed is roughly the speed of light. So they will be lying somewhere here. Okay, so what's shown here, let's start off with some things we know. This shows the Novi family, and the Novi family, they all roughly lie in this line, and it's called MMRD in this rather arcane literature, maximum magnitude rate of decay, which is to say that Novi which fade faster are brighter compared to Novi which fade slower. And you can see a very fast fading Novi becomes almost Eddington limit at a time scale of a few days. But some of the very long-lived novae can go for 100 days, but they're intrinsically dimmer, okay? Intrinsically not luminous. Okay, so you have this relation for novae, which has a slope of this sort, where faster, brighter. For supernovae, it's the opposite. We have supernovae typically at minus 19.5 for the 1As, for example. We are not talking about the shock breakout, the 2s, and so on. I'll talk about them a little later. Then you have this sort of 91 BG category, which is a subluminous supernovae, and they're redder, they evolve faster. So these are the actual few data points, and sometimes called the Phillips relation, which I've actually done a fit, and then it's sort of more or less, there's an extrapolation that I stopped arbitrarily at minus 16. Hopefully Wei Dong Li will tell us a little bit more whether I should have stopped at minus 16 or more. Okay, well then a little later in the next few slides I'll talk about what about supernovae which can use either different radioactivity or different amounts of radioactivity. Most supernovae have an ejecta mass about a solar mass, maybe 0.1. That's the rough range. Well, what about 10 to the minus 2 solar mass? It's not a crazy thing, because if you especially have a core collapse like a 1BC, here's this black hole, there's no reason why it shouldn't, in fact, accrete all of the matter, and you'd have no nickel left at all. So the amount of nickel left is always a mystery. So maybe it's 10 to the minus 2. Or why should it always be nickel? You know, it's not an obvious thing. Maybe it's neutrons, which might be more relevant for certain other kinds. So anyway, these are the models called macronovae, for lack of a better word, that the actual models which show that they would peak faster, and they would in fact be very underluminous, and this is roughly the track. None of these objects have been discovered. That's why it's in dotted lines. But this is what, if I take certain things with what we know, this seems reasonable. The pentagrams are all the shock breakouts, and this is what I meant, you know, the L naught I was talking about versus the square root of T, THTD is in fact where you place these, and I assume that the velocity of these explosions is a few times or comparable to the escape velocity, which one could question, but otherwise these are not really points that you have to spread them depending on the characteristics. Okay, so the part that has intrigued me in the last 6 months is there's this big gap between about minus 18, minus 17 for supernovae and minus 10. Okay, So I've been wondering about this for 6 months. It's been noted. This is not the first time someone has noted this gap, even to several papers in the 90s. Is this gap a barren desert? Are there things? And what I want to leave you with is, we already know there are objects in this gap here. And they're very, very different. They may not even belong to this family, and they're very different. And I think that's what is what I would say is a guaranteed return over the next few years, and I'll come back to this.
Before you go, what was that star on the far left?
I've forgotten. It is, I thought about it in the morning.
Unidentified transit. We're not allowed to look above that line anymore.
Yeah, something. I look at it and say, it's relativistic. Yeah, I'm not interested. I forget. it's been a while I made this little MATLAB program. Okay, so let's start with something. It's knowable, okay? Now, of course, all of you know the title of this workshop has been chosen with correct political rightness, and it's poetry from one of my heroes with slight variations on that theme. So this is a knowable transient, and we could have known and unknown, but I think we should, and then the four matrix elements, known, unknown, known, unknown. And then we could have in between knowable, and then I think we could do the same poetry, but with nine things now.
Are you saying Donald Rumsfeld is your hero?
Josh, you can't. We are buddies. okay. Well, I had to tell you this joke. Well, so, you know, I told I'll behave well myself, but I'm sorry, but you're now. Rumsfeld was asked, you know, like, why, you know, there are all these prisoners at Gitmo who had to stand up morning to evening. He said, what's the big deal? He stands up morning to evening. And I say, what's the big deal, too? I also stand up morning to evening because both of us had the same back operation which requires you to stand up. So, anyway, while this joke was going on, let me, black hole neutron stars. Well, this is the big deal thing. We all know short hard bursts. There's a speculation that they may, in fact, come from. Such coalescence. Okay. So you can see that there's stuff coming off here. Okay, and let's look at what this is. And we don't know what is the composition, but these will be low ejecta, unknown radioactivity, and potentially a long-lived engine. Okay, so. You can actually parameter these things by playing around with these options. The different source of radioactivity, these two choices, and then you could have a source which shines for a longer time. So I will skip this and say, in fact, you can do such fits, for example, one of the best studied short hard bursts, and you can get some very interesting limits, like the ejecta mass of 3 times 10 to the minus 4 solar masses if there are some free neutrons, because that alone, in fact, would lead to a detectable nova, except it'll peak in 1,000 seconds. What we don't know, maybe it's nickel. Well, problem with nickel is that it decays too slowly, and these are expanding at very high speed, so in fact, the resulting supernova would in fact be very short-lived, and here's a light curve in the luminosity versus time, and this would peak on a day and then it would be gone. Okay. So if you want to find these things, you have to react rather quickly. And finally, and this is thank Chris Covilito for suggesting these things, that if you have some novae which are very short, and brachy is a word for short in Greek. And for example, you could have a long-lived central source, long-lived only relative to the initial explosion, or long-lived accretion disk, then this will be reprocessed. This is basically the NOVA model, but with a new central source. Okay, so already you can look at some of these short hard bursts, and in fact, you can put some limits of potential magnetar for one of these short hard bursts. Okay, well, I thought, why stop at brachy? Then I went and did Google, I said opposite Greek, short. All that, within a minute I learned dolicho. Dolicho is apparently the right medical term for long. So you can have a dolicho nova, and there's an example of this. The best example of this, this is a picture of one we studied in a galaxy. But the original paper is luminous M giants in the bulge of M31, where in fact they reported a nova-like explosion reaching Eddington luminosity at minus 10, lasting several months. Okay. And so now, closing up, what I would like to say here is there's plenty of things to be done here. And there's a lot of interesting thing to react on timescales of seconds and so on. But we all know that's hard game. And my horizon is always 6 months or something of that sort. So this is something we can do now, easily. And what it is we could, there are things we can put here. I went through in a rush about macronova, which are neutron powered things, or very small amount of ejecta. If they're 1BC, most of the black hole sucks up most of it. Or certainly the shock breakout, which is inevitable. That doesn't require any source of heat at all, apart from the explosion. And then you have M31RV. And look at it, it is super Eddington, and lasts here a long time. Clearly it's not a nova. And then there's a galactic one. Unfortunately, we don't know the y-axis. We don't know the distance. There have been issues about that. And the weight of such objects is not negligible. You know, it's probably one in 10 years in M31. In our galaxy, it may be even larger, if you actually believe some of these things. So even doing a very simple search of the nearby galaxies, you would start finding these interesting objects. What would these be? Well, one idea is, in fact, these result from the coalescence of ordinary stars. So we've been talking of coalescence of neutron stars, which is all fascinating stuff. But for every such thing, there's a hell of a lot of ordinary stuff going on. And you can think of huge variations, radiative plus convective, planet plus star. And these can be incredibly as rich source of phenomena. And I think that's what we'll be finding. So I'll end with a standard nova cartoon. Brachynova, Dolichonova, macronova, whatever, but they're probably pretty good novae anyway, and it's a good thing to study them. Yeah.
Questions?
So the macronova you talked about haven't really been observed so far. So can you comment on how the observers should do to really catch those things and really study them?
Yeah. Well. Key, if you look at any of these models, the basic physics tells you, well, first you have to tell me, what do you think is the speed at which they expand? That sets the time scale, okay? And my view is that if you look at those simulations of black hole, you know, escape velocity from a neutron star black hole, stellar mass black hole, is a reasonable scale. So I use beta of 0.5, okay? So half C, in which case, and then you say, first, that's number one. That's very important, the scale, okay? Because the other one is like supernovae. They don't. They expand incredibly slowly, so you could do that too. But if you do 0.5, then you can say, okay, this is an actual burst, 0.5, 0.5, 0.9b. You find, and this is the model. This is optical, and this is the UV. It's slightly advantageous to work in the UV. And there are various issues which I didn't get into, which I don't think has been really dealt in the literature, which is because they evolve so fast, and a lot of the supernova models are really not applicable, because you've got to account for the photons you radiate, and so those are all the issues here which I won't go into. But you can see that this peaks about 10 to the 4 seconds and then dies down. And here it dies down due to transparency, basically, okay? If you have a slower, it'll take a little longer, but the time scale for this model has been set by the neutron decay, okay, effectively. So 10 to the 4 seconds is the whole game's over. So if the short hard burst happens, if you want to put limits, you know, it has to be done in the first few hours.
But then even if you observe it, are you sure it is the macronova you're talking about? You know, what effect is the cost of the
magnetic system? Wow, okay. You can't say, oh, there are lots of complications before one can immediately jump into. First of all, there's the afterglow itself, which you have to distinguish from the underlying, this non-relativistic part. Okay, let's say I can, because the afterglow is very well behaved and I can do a fit. But I would say there are a lot of answers. This game, the way to look at it is, this is a toy model that allows you to put in different radioactivity speeds and get a sense. It's only if you discover some bumps and so on that you go to town. If not, these numbers are only meaningful in the context that I have the right model. There's so much unknown. None of these guys who are coalescing these things, they can't tell you the nuclear composition to this degree. So by actually saying, oh, there'll be some fraction which are neutrons, it's not a bad assumption, but whether it is absolutely reasonable, I don't know. So Weidong's suggestion is, we just, you know, this is where the phase space helps. You just bash around, okay? But we have some idea which phase. So typically you do have to go to about, it's no point trying to do anything like 20th magnitude for this problem for a typical short hard burst in my mind. It's already ruled out in many ways.
Andromeda source, this is just a matter of numbers. It's minus 10, and you said it was Eddington, but isn't that actually pretty super Eddington?
Yeah, yeah. So I said, maybe I spoke a little fast. What I said, the Andromeda source is definitely, this is the Eddington limit, which is where the Novi max out.
So the Eddington limit is actually more like minus 8 or
something. No, -8.5, and there's some Novi which is a little brighter, but this one is clearly Eddington. It's an order of magnitude over any Eddington limit, no matter how I count it. I think the actual Eddington limit in this band is -8.5, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Massimo would. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's 4.10 to the 5 solar luminosities, and the sun is 5.5, so you subtract 11 from that, it's more like -6 or something.
Really? Okay, man.
The Novi or Super Red, I mean, there's.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this one is no question. That's how it stands out.
I mean, but normally that looks Novi or Super.
They're yeah, yeah, but they're not 10 times Super Eddington. Well, this one is clearly way above any Novi that we know in our galaxy. Apart from, it's different not only in the y-axis, but also in the x-axis, but the y-axis itself.
I'm just saying everything on that.
Okay.
Super Eddington,
right? Yeah. Maybe Alan will tell us.
Yeah.
Can you comment more on the limits on the rates of macronovae given the current or past supernova and novae?
Yeah, that's a good point. I steered clear of rates because it was a 20-minute talk, but certain things I can give comments on. It's pretty clear. Okay, let's go through a few things which are easier to compute. Okay, my guess is that these sorts of M31 RV-like objects, okay, people have been monitoring M31 now variously at various things. Will they get a detailed blow-by-blow account by Alan Shafter, but I would say it's 1 in 50 years. Okay, I mean, it's been extensively observed. In our own galaxy, there's so many claimed things, but I don't know their y-axis. V838 Mon, something in Sagittarius, something in Crew, and so on. But whether they're all this sort of super Eddington things, I don't know. So the rough rate, my view is that, you know, 10 to the 10 solar luminosity, it's 1 per 50 years. So if you do a survey, you know, with even like 22nd, 23rd magnitude, actually the Virgo cluster would be a nice one to do. I think you could get one a year. And they last a long time, so you don't have to, the cadence doesn't have to be very large. Okay. Now, the macronovae, well, these are intimately related to the, what is the perceived rate of short hard bursts. Udi, so if we go to 300 megaparsecs, how many optimistic short hard bursts would you expect without beaming? I mean, that is beamed, unbeamed, doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay, so I would say that's the rate of, and I said 300 because I think I know the scale of what is the kind of ejecta mass we're looking at. And most of these models suggest ejecta mass not exceeding 0.1 solar masses. So I think that's a reasonable outer scale, you know, just the L0 is, not L0, the peak luminosity decides how far you can. So there are 100, but now you have to worry. They only last 1,000, you know, they only last 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 seconds. The 100 over 4 pi over a year, and the last, you know, 10 to the 4 seconds. So this is a major effort in my mind. It's not a casual, okay, let's go do it and find this.
Well, but I mean, to be fair, they'd be fairly closely connected to galaxies. You wouldn't have to search all 4 pi. You'd have to go within some halo of all the galaxies.
Yeah, but at 300 megaparsecs, it's, I don't know, is there like, you know, the only search is you have a huge thing, right, and you get what you get? Am I wrong? I mean, you can target a little bit to, yeah, you can target a little bit. Yeah, but how many?
She's saying 300 megaparsecs. It's not like you have a detector that has, you know, 5 arc seconds here.
And yeah.
Here, you just have a light, so it can.
I mean, at some point, okay, if it's a Virgo cluster, I know. 6 by 6 degrees, here I am, okay? Maybe a few other clusters. But once you get to this distance, it's a little hard to fine-tune this. You know, you could choose the supergalactic plane, a few things, but the contrasts don't seem that large.
Maybe the answer is that using wide format cameras is not the way to go for this. You want smaller format.
Yeah, that's an interesting, yeah.
Lots of fields.
Yeah, that's an interesting suggestion. One should. No, he wants like an array of telescopes, each.
Sure.
Yeah, he wants a cyclops-like thing.
For like a factor of 2B or something, right?
You win in other ways, too.
Yeah, just a comment. If you look at these, if you wish, somewhat underluminous optical changes, then especially if you look at star black hole coalescence, you know, it always makes me think of that you're looking at a naked or a bare active nucleus in many ways. So, by all means, it may be very luminous as a source or burst effect of the radio. And so, what do you think maybe the prospects of doing a combined search for these in the optical and the radio?
Well, we have Dale Crail, Mr. Radio himself, so. Dale, do you want to comment? I mean, I have my own comments, but Dale? It's hard.
Very hard. One or two class A radio telescopes. Yeah. So
we'll be hearing talks from Jeff Fowler and Joe Lazio on projects in the future of that.
I have searched into a handful of nearby galaxies repeatedly as calibration.
Okay, let's thank Sri. So the next talk is by